push the red thing.
Yeah, we're recording, yes.
Okay, we're on what seems to be the Sunday after Christmas, Sunday between, often between, and the text is Isaiah 61:10 through 62:3, which is an odd ending. If we have time, I'm going to carry this through 62:5, which is where that little pericope ends, and it's actually kind of a fun part of the text. But let's start at 10 and even backtrack a little bit. In some ways, this is really part of a theme that probably begins with 60. Now, we know Isaiah 60 as the Epiphany reading, "Arise, shine, for your light has come." And maybe there's and the themes carry through about light and being the reflective light, having sort of the righteousness of God shown to the nations through us is certainly the theme of this pericope for today as well. So in your preaching, now one, relate this to the gospel, and Dr. Gibbs will be talking about that momentarily in the presentation of the temple. But it's almost a nice segue as we move from Christmas to Epiphany. That those are at the same time distinct, but really one and the same celebration of what the incarnation means for all the world and for those of us who become in Christ the light of the world. So I think there's a nice sort of sequencing here to get us from Christmas to Epiphany within these Isaiah texts. Well, let's translate. Sos asis, Adonai or Yahweh. Sos is infinitive absolute. This is one of these, there's about four or five familiar words for rejoicing. And, of course, with Hebrew poetry, you're always using at least two every time you want to use one. So, Sos is infinitive absolute. I will certainly rejoice in Yahweh. Tagel nafshi. This is technically Joseph. May my, or let my nefesh, the subject. Here's a good case where nefesh is probably simply code for I myself, let myself, or may I, but it's third singular, so it uses a third singular Joseph verb form, ta-gael. This is from gil, the hollow root gil. It's the same root in the Jewish song Hava Nagila, the cohortative form there. Let us rejoice. There you go. Sing a few bars. So may my, or let my nefesh rejoice, Be'elohai, in my God. Because, ki, or for, Hilbishani, he has lavashed. This is the word for to put on clothes. In the kal, it means to put on clothes, get dressed. In the hifil, it's to clothe something else. So he has clothed me, for he has clothed me, you'd add with, this is beged, garments, but in the plural construct, with begeds of yesha, with garments of salvation, with the mantle of righteousness, or with a mantle of righteousness, he has adorned, put something on me. Ata probably means, this is from ata, a third hay. There's a flag on the play. It's a kind of a goofy form, but everybody sort of agrees it's a ta to sort of put on good clothes, get dressed up. Sometimes translated adorned. I think the suggestion in the footnote is to read this as a hifil. He has caused me to put on good clothes, which kind of continues the hifil of the lavash verb in the first half. Again, a nice little chiastic line. You got verb, object, object, verb. Smell of roses a little bit as you go by. Jeff, you can't read this without thinking of baptismal language,
right,
can you? The
right.
Putting on the clothes, the garments of salvation. It's just wonderful. Come on in. Join the party.
Join the throng.
We're in Isaiah 61. 10. He has, verse 3, or sorry, line 3. Like a chatan, that's a bridegroom. It's an interesting, I should look up, this is quite rare, that you actually have kahan used as a verb form. And it's a, there are a couple times here in these latter chapters of Isaiah, I've never really studied that, especially in relationship to the rest of the Old Testament, but it would be an interesting observation. Everyone knows the vocable kohen as priest, but it's actually from kohen would be the participle of a verb, kahan, to function as priest, and here it's actually used as a verb form. But it doesn't really mean function at priest. This is sort of a metaphorical use. Like a bridegroom, what? Puts on priestly-like garments. Pa'ar is one of those verbs for nice stuff, glory, adornment, things that are beautiful. You were playing the old golden pyramid game. Things that are beautiful. Like a bridegroom... sort of adorns himself like a priest, I guess. It's kind of interesting that the priesthood, one of the keys, sort of semiotic functions of the priesthood was to look really sort of special. Now again, that's being marked in an unmarked context where the priest, nobody ever dressed up. You didn't have too many fancy clothes, so wearing fancy clothes was really something you did only for really special things. So the adornment of the priestly vestments was also sort of a symbolically rich way of saying this is something really special we're doing here. It is extraordinary in the real sense of that word. So like a bridegroom adorns himself, dresses up like a priest, and like a bride, this is Kala, the bride, she puts on her... This is a great idiom. Her stuff, her things. Kali is one of the most mundane words in Hebrew. Every language has a verb like thing, das Ding, a race in Latin, and that's what Kali is. But it here it means her, probably her jewels, her jewelry, her best stuff. 11. For as the earth Totsi causes to come forth its, the antecedent of her is Eretz here, her tzemach, her branch, if you will, her growth, and like a gana, you all know gan, this is just another form of it, gana, garden, or park, and like a park, or garden, her, or its, sown stuff, zerah, to sow a seed, this is probably a noun, kind of a passive participle, what is sown. So her sown stuff causes to tzamak, causes to grow up. Thus, Adonai Yahweh will cause to grow up tzedakah and tehillah before all the nations. Now you get to the punchline, and now the sort of parable is complete. Like a garden, and the earth causes righteousness, or its stuff to grow, for the glory of joy of the planter, so Adonai Yahweh and the hifil shouldn't be lost here. I mean, this is a little sola gratia that God causes righteousness and praise, tehillah from halal to praise, to spring up like seeds, and it's kol hagoyim before all the nations. This is Israel as a light to the nations again. Okay, 62. Laman Zion lo eshsha. For the sake of Zion, I will not... now here you got two verbs that are, again, synonyms. Kasha, and at the end of the line, shakat, which means to rest. Kasha probably means to be quiet, restful, usually translated silent. For the sake of Zion, I will not be silent. For the sake of Jerusalem, I will not be still, however you want to do that. Now again, let me do a mini aside here into the larger question of the book of Isaiah. You know, if you actually want to read the book as a whole, which is a remarkably new idea, even amongst biblical scholars, much of the early, you know, we just translated Isaiah 6 in class, and where he says, make the eyes of this people blind, or in their ears plaster shut, lest they see and hear. There's this kind of silencing of the voices. And now, there is silence no more. It's kind of like taking the hallelujah out of Lent and then letting her rip when Easter comes. We don't really do that liturgically in Advent, but there is something about Advent being a little bit more somber, and then Christmas you finally let her rip a little bit, and then the hallelujahs come out. It's this sort of waiting. It's this sort of reflectiveness. It's even more than that. It's understanding blindness so that you might truly appreciate sight. So God is not going to be quiet anymore until, what's his goal here? Until Yetzah, until it goes forth like light, Noah, her tzedek, her righteousness. Who's the her here? Well, it's probably the people of God again, but remember in the previous verse, he has caused it to come forth. And her meaning Zion and Jerusalem, that's the antecedent in the previous verse. Until her light goes forth, until her tzedek, her righteousness goes forth like light, and her salvation like a lamp burns, from Ba'ar. And the goal here, Goyim will see your tzedek. That's a good study in itself, the Goyim in the book of Isaiah, which in chapter 2 come to Zion, already in the last of days, to listen and learn and hear the Devar Yahweh as it goes forth from Zion. But in real life, the nations come to Zion to plunder and destroy. And now, in the great reversal here at the end of the book, they come to see the light of God's declaration of salvation. So this kind of reversal from darkness to light, then from silence to speech to joy, is all carried out here. But it's also, again, for the sake of the nations. This isn't Israel for the sake of Israel, or the church for the sake of the church. It's the church as the medium of God's salvation for all people. So Goyim will see your tzedek, and all kings, your kavod, your glory. And again, to make the point one more time, it's not really ours. We're the reflective. That goes back to chapter 60. And I'm kind of picking up the wedding or even childbirth naming theme. Kura lak shem kadash. And now here's a bonus point. If anybody can parse Kol Ra, you get extra points. This is a little bit of a stump the stars one. It's actually
a Kol participle.
Looks like a Kol participle.
Does it actually look like that? Even well, if it's not that, I get some credit.
You get some credit for the holum.
And I figured that the long vowel at the end was just because it was an.
Because an olive, sure. It would, however, be a serae if it were a Kol participle. It'd be Kol Re.
That could be an MDiv student.
Yeah, that's at least as good as an MDiv student, Dr. Gibbs. That's very good.
Thank you.
It is, in fact, a pool.
I'm exhausted now.
And one of those, you don't expect pools much at all. And not with karat, it's kind of an odd form. But it's a pool with the holum lengthened because you can't double the resh. So something, it will be called to you a new name. Which the P Yahweh, which the mouth of Yahweh, will nakav. That'd be another form to parse, though this is just looks weird, even though it's not as bad as it sounds. It's a first nun. The nun is simply assimilated. So it's nakav, designate, to kind of indicate, which the mouth of Yahweh has designated it. It's a redundant pronoun, the new name. And now we kind of get to the punchline again, verse 3. And you will be a crown and a teret of tiferet. It actually rhymes. A crown of righteousness, not righteousness, glory. Didn't we have par up in 10C? This is one of these beauty words. A crown of beauty, biyad Yahweh, in the hand of Yahweh. And a tsanif is a word for headdress or similar to crown, diadem. I'm never quite sure what a diadem really is, other than it's some sort of a hairpiece, isn't it? Miluka is adjectival, a royal diadem in the hand of your God. Now that's where the text ends, and that's a fine place to end. You will be, and again, maybe that's a sermon theme. Huh? We're like the crown jewels in the kingdom of God, in the sense God adorns who He is with the glory He's given to us. But more importantly, we show forth the glory of the King, not of ourselves. But it's really about the King before all the nations. If I got a minute left, verses 4 to 5.
Yeah, you got about 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah. Continues the new name. See, why you stop here when he just said you will be called, given a new name, and then he doesn't tell them what the new name is. In 4, there is a new name. Not will be called to you anymore, owed, Azuvah. And to your land, not it will be called anymore, Shimamah. Now, in Isaiah 6, this is the word pair that they have to get beaten down until they are a land that is a Shimamah, desolation, and your land is an Azuvah, that is the cow passive participle of Azav, forsaken. So this is, to me, a clear echo of Isaiah 6. And to you it will be called, so you won't be called forsaken and desolation, but to you it will be called, for be, Keptzavah. Now, you can do two things with Keptzavah. You can translate it as, O Keptzavah, and there actually was a person named Keptzavah in the Old Testament, or you can translate the name, and it means my delight is in her, and to your land, Be'ulah, this is the old Beulah, which is literally the cow passive participle of Baal, here in the sense of married. Remember, being without husband and also without children was really not a good thing for all sorts of reasons, including the way God really intended us to be, I think. And He made us male and female and all of that. But this is almost metaphorical also for the people. Remember, the metaphor here is Yahweh is the bridegroom and His people are the bride. Paul didn't think this up about being the bride of Christ. It comes out of Isaiah 62. So it's the, and throughout these passages too, the land is desolate, is compared to a widow, a woman who is widowed and without children. That's why the children come into play in the next verse. So that metaphor is really a strong one. So you will be called Keptzavah and your land married, if you will, for Yahweh delights in you and your land will be married. And that's carrying forth this having a husband and your land, which also becomes kind of a metaphor for your children. You got the sons coming in the next line. As a bridegroom marries his Betulah, a virgin, really, so your sons will marry you. And all the commentaries go, why sons here? And again, the sons and the land are kind of metaphors for the next generation and what it means to bring forth the next generation, which means you're doing what God intended you to do, and not only bringing them forth, but bringing them forth as people of God who will reflect the glory of God to all the nations. This to a people without land, to a people in exile, to a people without hope. Don't forget that context, which is why this is so powerful. And as a bridegroom rejoices over... No, I'm sorry, verse 5, I wasn't paying attention. Bachor is really the young man. Like, this is from Bachar, who's kind of a macho guy, a stud guy, a good-looking guy, marries a virgin. And now you get to 5. This is the bridegroom. As the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God will cease over you, will rejoice over you. Now I'll circle back one more time and talk about Keptzavah. Who was she? Does anyone know? It's a good Bible trivia question.
Jemima was one of Job's daughters.
She was the wife of Hezekiah and the mother of Manasseh.
Oh, boy.
And if we ever get this thing written up, I got to write this up in an article. Nobody thinks about this because nobody in their right mind would connect Isaiah 62 to anything early in Isaiah.
Right, yeah.
Huh. But if who are the players in Isaiah 7? Well, Ahaz in Isaiah.
Yeah.
If there's some connection at least to the Davidic line and a Davidic son,
right.
Everybody thinks at least one candidate, if you want to find a type of Emmanuel there, is Hezekiah. But Hezekiah is born already. But the point is that the next generation would be Hezekiah and a woman named Hephzibah, and the next generation is Manasseh, who forever whatever hope you had in Hezekiah was dashed in Manasseh. And I think he's looping back to that whole episode somehow here, and kind of saying now we're going to get. I mean, the point the paraphrase here would be now we're going to get the Davidic promise right. Manasseh turned out to be another great swing and a miss.
Right.
But still coming into the future in this great eschatological joy that comes when God finally delivers the child, we're getting David's son, who's also David's Lord, and now we got it right. That ought to preach, hey, for Christmas?
I think so, yeah.
And now we get...